My name is Emily Barmer and I have the hearing suite here in Harrogate. Welcome to the Harrogate Health Show. Today I am joined by the fabulous Michelle LaRoche. So Michelle,
tell me about Paris.
Oh, it was fantastic. We went for 3 days. We thought we'll do one day at the show.
Nice.
And then have a couple of days sightseeing in Paris. With all 3 days at the show.
Really?
Loved it. Okay. So a lot of things are going away from branding at the moment. On the continent and in London. It hasn't hit the north as yet. People are still asking for brands. And there are certain brands, such as Tom Ford, which we still love, has been around for quite a long time. And yet that it will fade at some point, but it doesn't seem to be happening at any point soon.
Okay.
But such as the razzle and dazzle of the things with stones in. We were looking for a new product.
Action.
Yes, because we've been with Chopard, who have done beautiful things, but I've been looking for something that isn't branded,
okay,
but has got the beautiful stone, which tends to be the Italians.
Ah.
But the Italians are very much very large, oversized, round, which doesn't really suit the Collingham clientele.
No.
But it's really exciting to go and see it. So actually the Deirdres are coming back.
Oh, goodness me. When did the Deirdres come through the first time?
Back in the 80s.
Was it
I don't know if you're too young to remember them.
I can remember my grandpa had some Deirdres. I think they're still in an office somewhere.
Wow,
so
okay.
They are updated on the 80s, obviously.
Fantastic.
It's very large, oversized, which is beautiful, very glamorous.
Yes.
But it's quite difficult to wear, particularly if your eyes are quite close together.
Ah, okay.
So what they're doing on the continent is they're putting beautiful tints in to accentuate them. So actually, I always talk about the fit of a frame and how it fits on the nose first and your eyes fit centrally, but with an oversized frame you don't get that.
Okay.
But actually doing a pale graduated tint, it's not as noticeable, and they tend to call them cocktail or aperitif tints on the continent. So we're very excited about that. It's not just the frames, it's the tints going into them, so to make them wearable.
That sounds gorgeous. So they're conventional glasses, essentially.
Yes. So oversized, beautiful, going away from the branding, all about the frame rather than the name on the frame.
Nice.
So I'm very excited to be seeing some of those. We've got a few of the Tom Fords have already just come into practice this week already, and then the new brands, I'm seeing some this week, and then the brand that we've been working with, Dario Martini, already, and they're brought in through a distributor through the UK, but that distributor tends to look at the Dario Martini brands and thinks, right, I like that front but that side for the UK market.
Okay.
So I was very lucky to be able to go and see the full Dario Martini range in Paris and actually choose from some of the originals, so no one else will have them in the UK in that particular way.
See, I'd never realised that buyers were looking at UK tastes.
Yes.
As opposed to, because you do often go away to places like Paris or Rome and look at particularly women there and think how stylish they are with the frames that they're wearing.
Yes, absolutely.
And to think that we just don't have access to them.
No, so I go and try and look at what is over there. And yes, some of it has to be made a little bit more wearable for the north of England. But it's looking at that styles and those influences and making it wearable, but yet still stylish and that je ne sais quoi that's a little bit different to what you'll find on the high street.
Fantastic. And how do you get on stepping away from your own taste, because you must have styles of glasses that you would feel suit your face and suit you and your fashion. How do you find kind of stepping away from that and looking at other people?
Yes, it's keeping an open mind as well, really.
Because
I don't particularly like metal frames at the moment, but I think I will have to change my mind on that one because they're going back into fashion.
Are they?
As well. But it's looking at beautiful pieces, and we always talk to people about the fit. So what fits me might not fit someone else.
Okay.
But if we can work with a fit from someone, and then actually you'll see in magazines that say if you've got X-shaped face, you should wear Y-shaped frame, which is part of it. But if you look at the fit first, you can actually wear different shapes and colours and styles. And just with your clothes, some things will accentuate you a little bit better than others. But there's a whole visual wardrobe of frames that you can wear. And as such, with the size, we can do things with tints and with the lenses. So it's that whole package together at the end of the day that makes you feel special in your eyewear.
And how do people sort of get the confidence to try something different?
We just tell them to try it on. Or ask them to try it. And I think that's the thing, because sometimes you look at something off the shelf, and it's no secret that I love a little bit of bling. Doesn't mean that you have to look like Dame Edna Everage, but sometimes just a little bit of sparkle, and it doesn't have to be huge stones, but sometimes just a little bit of sparkle, that just little change in texture can just actually light your eyes up. And we get a lot of ladies coming, oh no, I don't like sparkle, and we'll just try it, and oh, actually, yes, they do. And it's the same with gents as well. I had one gentleman that came in and said, oh, Michelle, you know, I'm not being funny, I've been wearing glasses for 18 years and I know what suits me and this is the style. So it's about pushing the boundaries, but it's keeping people comfortable in what they want to wear as well. And sometimes it is that actually we can put a frame on somebody that really is a bold statement and they look great in, but that's not the statement that they want to make. So it's having maybe a slight change from what they've had previously. Or if somebody's dead set that that is what they want, then obviously that is what we'll go for, providing that the fit is okay, and then recommend the ideal lenders to go in it too.
Okay, and that leads on really nicely into talking a bit more about your practice, really, because I've never been in an optician's like your practice. Can you tell people a little bit more about what it's like and the feel and the kind of goal with it if they haven't been to visit you already?
Yeah, so it was my vision to have a practice that was almost like walking into your front room to choose your glasses, because it's a considered purchase and it's not necessarily wanted to be done in a clinical environment. So we like you to come and sit down and have a cup of tea or a cup of coffee, and it does feel like a boutique environment to choose them from. There's not rows and rows of glasses on hooks on the wall, but there are quite a few to look at, and we'll always have a starting point. And then we've actually got an old architect's chest where we've got lots of our frames. And sometimes you can have too much choice and be spoilt for choice, whereas if we know what you're looking for and what you like about a frame, Janet and I both know the full stock, so we can then go through it and adjust it from there. Then upstairs I have my clinical room, which is, the lighting's different, it's fully clinical upstairs, but it's nice to have the two married together.
Definitely. It's that kind of feeling of luxury in healthcare, isn't it? Somewhere yes. That actually you might quite enjoy, that your next eye test or you're due a new pair of glasses or something like that, and that you've got to come and visit you.
Yeah, very much as yourself, as you do with the hearing suite, Emily, yes. It's actually the brain that sees, not the eyes.
Okay.
So really at university we're taught to put an image on the retina and check that there's no pathology in the eye.
Okay.
But looking at the behavioural model of the eye, 80% of the impulses go through to the visual cortex, but 20% go to the superior colliculi, which it's that then reacts with the rest of the auditory system, proprioceptor, yeah, and everything else going on in the body. So actually, children perhaps that have had glaucoma as a child, they can often have problems with their visual tracking and their peripheral vision because they haven't heard those loud bangs, yes, in the periphery, which they've then turned to look at to develop their peripheral vision. So it's looking at that model of the eye with the rest of the body, not just the eyes in isolation.
And you've done a lot of studying recently around new and innovative practices there.
Yes, so it blows my mind really, because optometry is taught as a science at university. It's very much black and white, but actually there's a lot more of a grey area. And I think the eyes are amazing, but then when you start to look at the brain too, it literally is quite mind-blowing, and looking at how the two work together.
Remind me how long you've been in optometry.
Sorry. You're making me feel that old
now. I have a number in my head to still have that passion for learning new things. It's quite inspiring.
Yes, so I've been working in optics for 26 years and I've been qualified as an optometrist for 20 years.
Gosh.
Yeah, so yes.
Experience.
And it's fascinating. And when I qualified 20 years ago, the movement now with the technology that we have is available, it really is exciting. And that has renewed my love of optometry along the line. Yes, it's very interesting. It's tough. You're not taught it at university. No. But such as with the OCT and retinal imaging that we have now and what we can tell from that. And then also with the behavioural work. And that just came about quite by chance, in that opening a fully private practice was a big step for me. And initially, looking at it from a business point of view, I thought, well, why would people bring their children to me when you can get two pairs of glasses free on the NHS somewhere else?
Yeah.
So I thought, oh, this sounds quite interesting. And spoke to Ruth Lowe, who's a behavioural optometrist up in Glasgow, actually.
Oh, gosh.
At a conference that was up there. I thought, oh, yeah, that sounds quite interesting. And then I think potentially because my youngest son has learning difficulties, it started to pull at my heartstrings.
Of course.
But I'm one of these people that I like to see things that they work and know that they work before I start talking about them. So I'm still a little bit, you know, is it really going to work? What's it all about? So I decided to do the courses a course and think, right, I'll have a look at it. If I'm not convinced by it, I might be able to do something to help Matthew, my son.
Yeah.
Anyway, that was 6 courses ago. I'm hooked now. And it is that it's about helping people, and it's fascinating. And when you look at it and look at this model of the eye, it is actually blindingly obvious, but I'd never thought of it in that way before. So going forward, how we can do that and work with children and adults with learning difficulty, improve sports vision as well, and also with brain injury. So perhaps if part of the brain dies, such as in stroke, the incidence of stroke now is increasing. A lot of younger people are having strokes.
Absolutely.
And in a very basic way, it's then about moving the image to a part of the brain that can see and retraining the brain to see in that way.
Gosh.
And with the children and adults with learning difficulties, often they will have 20/20 vision. Their image falls on the retina there or thereabouts. They'll go for a standard eye examination and be told they don't need glasses. But actually, it's their visual processing. And as I say, I'm still studying, but dyslexics, it's always thought as a disadvantage. But look at some of the people that have dyslexia, such as
Richard Branson.
Yes, I was going to say that. And look at his business ethics. And these people tend to just think outside the box. And actually, they have amazing brains. They just work in a slightly different way. So actually, I feel it's encompassing that. And dyslexia, the way their brain works is amazing.
Now, I live with a dyslexic. And he was diagnosed with dyslexia in his 30s. And I think for me, the biggest benefit of knowing that he's dyslexic is that I'm patient with him.
Yeah.
But I look back at school reports and pieces of work that he put together. When I compare him to his nephews, they're writing stories. He was using the same words in different paragraphs, but spelling them entirely differently.
Yes.
Dyslexia is something that affects a lot of people. The kind of work that you're doing, what does that do for someone with dyslexia specifically?
So it helps, we help them with their visual processing.
Okay.
And often, depending on which papers you read, 97 to 100% of dyslexics have a problem with their visual processing.
Wow, gosh.
So actually, some of that can go back to primitive reflexes. So sometimes we'll build on that as well. And then the vision training with working on their accommodation. So that's the ability of the eye to change focus at different distances, and the convergence, the ability of the eyes to move in and out. And actually, when you put those back in place, I'm not claiming to be able to cure dyslexia, but when you put that back in place and then you change, you're able to work on the visual processing, can help with spelling and going forward in different ways, and the mirroring that you get with words also.
Wow. So if somebody has dyslexia, or somebody has a child or grandchild with dyslexia, what sort of age would someone like you normally see them?
It's probably about the age of 7.
Okay.
When it starts to become more noticeable, whereas they may have learned to write quite easily, but then it's usually with the phonics and the blending of words together. And then when you're starting to see more letters on a page rather than just one or two, you might have heard of dyslexics saying that the words move or they jumble around. And if you look on the websites, you'll see, and actually if you're looking at, say, 3 words on a page moving around, you can still follow them and track with your eyes. But if you've got a paragraph on a page moving around, it makes it a lot more difficult to follow.
So that's if they're younger. Is there anything that can be done to support someone who's maybe had a later diagnosis of dyslexia?
Yes, we can still look at that too.
Okay.
And sometimes it's more noticeable in puberty as changes happen in the body that they can cope as they're younger, and then puberty arises.
Okay.
And such as people who didn't know they were dyslexic, or we can always look and assess them and work later in life too.
Okay, so dyslexia, are there any other specific ones that people might come across in their kind of loved ones that are really...
tend to be interlinked sort of with dysgraphia, okay. And those things too.
Okay, fantastic.
Often it's sometimes that you might just feel that your child isn't reading well, not quite doing as well as, but we don't like our children to be A stars, but me included. But it's, you might just feel that they're not doing quite well. With my own son, and I think that's where it came from with Matthew, because he was my youngest son. At the age of 3, and I remember when it was the Tour de France rather than the World Cycling Championship, when the Tour de France came to Yorkshire the first time, and we were walking through the village, and somebody put a yellow bicycle on a roof, and my 7-year-old at that time just walked straight past it, didn't even notice it, and Matthew at the age of 3 stopped dead and said, "Mummy, do you think they used a pulley system or a ladder to get that up there?"
Oh, goodness me.
So I knew that it was quite special at that age to be thinking about those types of things.
Yeah.
I thought, oh, this is my bright child. And he started off at school writing quite neatly, really, to say I'd not had that much influence because I wanted him to learn the school way rather than having lots of different ways, which had happened with my other son. But then he's quite articulate in his speech, but trying to get that down onto paper is just like another child.
Gosh.
So I knew, and he, I think he's an auditory learner actually.
Okay.
But so I knew how he could speak, how he could express himself through words spoken, but can't get things down on paper, that there was something different here. And that has encouraged me to look further as well.
That makes a lot of sense. It does, because again, what I've read around dyslexia, their IQs tend to be elevated, if anything.
Absolutely.
It's just, it almost masks that side of them. The other thing that I thought would be really useful to know would be kind of 3 tips. So for anyone really, in terms of taking care of their eyes, how often they should be having eye tests, just kind of 3 takeaways really for the everyday person.
Okay, so number one, I would say, is lifestyle. Mm-hmm. And when I was younger, I used to think that going to the gym or exercising was all about fitting into a size 10 dress. Shows how old I am, because it's now size 0, isn't it? But that was my thought.
Gosh, I hope not.
And then actually, it was that you should be doing this and it's good for your heart. But actually, do you know what? It's good for your eyes too.
Okay.
So the eye is very vascular. The eye is the only view of the body that we can see blood vessels without getting a scalpel out.
Wow.
So that's why diabetics have photographs taken of their eyes every year, because if it's happening to the blood vessels in the eye, the chances are it's happening around the rest of the body as well. So good diet and exercise. Diet, leafy green vegetables, all the red pigments, tomatoes, red peppers, really helps your pigment epithelium.
Wow.
If you're not having a good diet, then take a supplement. There are certain supplements that are recommended for people with macular degeneration, but a lot of multivitamins these days, if you look at them, will have lutein in, which is one of the top ones.
Lutein.
For your eyes. So that would be my number one tip.
Okay.
Number 2 tip would be to have regular eye examinations. It's usually at least every 2 years. Sometimes it's every year if there's a history of glaucoma in your family, if you're over 70. Children, every year, sometimes more frequently if they're depending on their prescription. And then number 3, I would say wear sunglasses.
Ah, okay.
Regardless of whether you need a prescription or not, wear sunglasses. Nice, large, to cover your eyes. As we get older, the UV light can cause early cataracts, and even in children.
Gosh.
So I would say wear sunglasses.
Wear sunglasses. And what about winter? Because I think a couple of years ago, we'd have almost been laughed at for putting sun cream on in winter, and now we know that we still need those SPFs on our skin.
Yes.
Sunglasses in winter?
Absolutely. You may find that a polarising lens helps you in winter as well.
Okay.
Because that will cut down the glare on the road that you'll get from a frosty morning or wet as well.
Fantastic. Well, thank you ever so much.
Thank you.
It's been really interesting to talk to you.
Sure. So yes, you can find us in Collingham on the main street, and our website is www.laroche.co.uk, or our telephone number is 01937 919381.
Well, thank you again.
Thank you.
Fabulous. The Harrogate Health Show is proudly sponsored by The Hearing Suite.